Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help the military community succeed in their civilian career and life. Today is episode number 341, From Air Force to U.S. Ambassador with Gary Grappo.
And of course, it was after that, then I was named by President to be the U.S. Ambassador in Oman. 3 years in that position, and then I was asked by the secretary to go to Iraq. So I had a pretty diverse career, although much of it obviously spent in the Middle East. I always felt that if you wanted to do that roll up your sleeve, hands-on work of diplomacy, there was no more challenging place in the world than the Middle East, and that certainly proved correct. It was indeed very, very challenging.
There is so much to appreciate about today's interview. First of all, diplomacy in the Foreign Service. This is the first interview I've done around the Foreign Service, and I started off in the deep end of the pool, to say the least. Gary went from Air Force officer to the U.S. ambassador to Oman. He had an incredible career in which he was involved in monumental work around the world. However, what I appreciate most about Gary is the humility and specificity he brings to this interview. It's not just about why veterans may enjoy a career in the Foreign Service. And by the way, Gary makes a pretty solid argument for this. It's the texture he brings to the conversation of finding his own career path, starting over again in the Foreign Service after earning his MBA and after working in the corporate world, in being diligent and learning a new craft and working his way up after having done that in both the military and the corporate world. It was a privilege to be able to learn from Gary, and I sincerely hope you enjoy this candid and enlightening conversation. As always, at beyonduniform.org, you'll find show notes with links to everything we discuss in this interview. You'll also find over 340 interviews for free, just like this one, classified by career path, company size, functional area, industry, you name it. We offer live webinars every single week, as well as on-demand webinars that we've done in the past. If you've been listening to Beyond the Uniform for a while, please consider sharing this with your friends and family. Please consider leaving a positive review on iTunes. And if you feel motivated, donating to keep this cause going. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Ambassador Gary Grappo. Well, joining me today, also in Denver, Colorado, my guest is Ambassador Gary Grappo. Ambassador, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
So for listeners, I wanted to give a very abbreviated bio for Gary, and I'll have more in the show notes at beyonduniform.org. But Gary is a distinguished fellow at the University of Denver and the CEO and founder of Equilibrium International Consulting. He served as the United States Ambassador to Oman from 2006 to 2009, and previously was Deputy Chief of Mission and Minister Counselor of the United States Mission in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. He served in the U.S. Air Force for over 8 years and holds a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics from the United States Air Force Academy, a Master's of Science in Geodesy and Survey Engineering from Purdue University, and an MBA from the Stanford University Graduate School of Business. So Gary, maybe to start things off, could you take us back to your transition from the Air Force and what that was like?
Sure, and I'll try and spare you some of the more nitty-gritty details, but I had planned to leave the Air Force about a year and a half before my actual departure in 1980. And so, of course, like anyone else, I started looking around and seeing what was available that would address some of the interests that I had. And I thought I had something lined up, and lo and behold, the Air Force informs me that, no, indeed, I owed them another year of service. Maybe some of the listeners can sympathize with that. So I was obviously disappointed and frustrated because I was all ready to launch into this new career. But in fact, Justin, it gave me time to really think more about what I might want to do, look at some other options that were that might be available to me. And indeed, I did that. And that's when I happened on maybe returning to graduate school and undertaking something outside of the hard sciences, and mathematics. And I went to business school for a couple of years. And in hindsight now, of course, I look back and say, wow, I was really fortunate that I had that extra year. So I suppose I should be thankful to the Air Force for not letting go so soon. And as it was when I left the Air Force, in a few months, I was off to Palo Alto and the business school.
I love that sometimes those speed bumps or unexpected curveballs can be frustrating at the time, but then maybe turn out to be this blessing in disguise, as it was in your case.
Absolutely.
One of the things, Gary, that I was so excited to talk to you about, and when we had coffee, we touched on this, was it from my perspective, you've really taken a road less traveled from two perspectives. One is from the military. There's not a lot of people I've seen that have your career path from the military, even though it makes a lot of sense. And certainly we both share business school at Stanford. I can't think of many people that have taken this career path from business school. And I'd love for you to share a little bit more about how you started down this path and how you, I guess we would group this into maybe just calling it foreign service, but how you entered into that as a vocation.
Well, my career track confounds a lot of people, understandably. And I tell my students when they come to see me or anyone really interested in the foreign service or just some type of work abroad, you probably want to consider not taking the track that I did. Indeed, in the Air Force, I spent 8 years working in the field of geodesy and cartography, right at that critical time when we were beginning the transition for the more conventional means for precision surveying and mapping geodesy, in particular, to satellite technology. And as a result, and I was very fortunate to be able to do this, I traveled extensively around the world. I would take small teams with me, mid to senior level NCOs who themselves had fairly extensive technical training and backgrounds. And we traveled all over the world. Most of the places where we went, there were no military bases or facilities. We usually check into an embassy and then head off to usually the boondocks to do the work we had to do. And that really sparked an interest in everything about the world outside the United States, including international affairs, history, cultures, and so forth. And I began reading everything I could get my hands on, from The Economist to all sorts of books. And I really kept this interest after I left the Air Force at business school. After I left business school, I went to work in the private sector in finance. I did work for a couple of companies that did extensive work abroad, and I thought that's where I would find my home. And it was pretty satisfying work. It was very interesting. But I'll be quite honest and frank here, I miss public service. Between the 4 years I spent at the academy, 8 years in the Air Force, I really felt this sort of gravitational pull to public service. And I decided to take the Foreign Service exam. You take an exam to enter the Foreign Service, everyone does. And I passed. And I did confound almost all of my fellow entering candidates for the Foreign Service, because most of them had studied foreign languages, international affairs, political science, economics, and there was this interloper with a bachelor's degree in math and physics.
I was going to ask this later, but it just kind of stands out to me now, is having such a different background, both the hard science background as well as the military experience, in what ways did that benefit you in this career path?
I actually thought that I was advantaged by that career path, because I had such a wide diversity of experiences. I'd spent time in the military. I had worked in some fairly large science and R&D projects, including the development of the GPS system. And then, of course, my time in the private sector. So by the time I got to the State Department, I was almost seen as the gray hair in the room, although my hair wasn't as gray as it is today. And because I had done all of these things, I had traveled extensively overseas. It was something with which I was really familiar. I had lived in a couple of countries by then. And so by the time I started my work in the Foreign Service, I was pretty comfortable with most of that. It's just, of course, acquainting myself with the ins and outs of the sometimes Byzantine or arcane administrative structure of the State Department and the way they operate.
And I'm guessing going from finance to the Foreign Service, I'm guessing there was a pretty substantial pay cut to make that transition. Is that true? And if so, was that difficult for you or your family to make that sort of jump?
Oh, yes. to put it bluntly, my wife must have asked me a dozen times, are you sure you really want to do this? Because I was working for a bank that had operations all over the world. It was considered a major international bank. And of course, the salary is quite attractive and it's doing well. They seem to like me. And all of a sudden, I up and went off to go back to the government. And I did indeed take a pay cut. It was a little difficult for about the first year, but we adjusted, got used to it, accommodated ourselves to life in the Foreign Service, working inside embassies and the kind of work that American diplomats do. And I really never looked back.
One of the things I really admire about your story is it seems from an external standpoint, like you had this clarity that this was a career path in alignment with what fulfilled you. And despite the doubt of your peers and classmates, and even some pushback from family, you made that courageous leap. And I'm just curious your advice for anyone listening who may be considering a leap of their own. That could be from the military to something else. They could have already transitioned to be thinking of making a pretty dramatic career change that feels right to them. Do you have any advice about, I can only imagine how much doubt must have spiked occasionally, and there must have been this question of like, is this the right thing? What advice do you have for people considering making a similar transition in their own life?
No, I think you've really hit the target here. Let me first say that kind of clarity did not occur to me for a while. I went through these different types of career experiences, and in every single one, most of the time people would have said, wow, you're doing really terrific here. And then I uprooted and went someplace else. Even after joining the Foreign Service, there was some lingering doubt. But I think after about the first year or so, my first assignment was a junior political officer in our embassy in Managua, Nicaragua, where we were dealing with a very difficult government, a very leftist-leaning, anti-American government. And I found the work enormously interesting and challenging, exciting. It was intellectually challenging. And that's when I began to realize this is where I belong. Mm-hmm. And so if I reflected back on everything else I had done before, as I said, it wasn't really clear. It just, thankfully, my path took me there. And so the advice that I would pass on to either those currently serving on active duty and considering leaving service, as well as those veterans, is to be very patient, keep all your options open, be curious about what is out there, and don't forget what interests you the most. There is a passion, I think, in every one of us. Sometimes it just doesn't emerge for a while until we are in the right kind of circumstances or environment where we realize, as I did, I really belong here. This is what I can do, what I want to do, what I'm excited to do. And that takes some trial and error, as it did for me. It takes a great deal of patience, including a lot of frustration. That year that I spent in the Air Force before my term of service was up was quite frustrating. I don't hold any grudges today. In fact, I look quite fondly back at my service in the Air Force. But at the time, I was a little bitter because I was ready to go. I thought I'd completed my service. I hadn't. Okay, still owe. I hung in there and did the work. Actually, the work they ended up doing was extremely interesting. And it was the development of the GPS system, which I'm actually very proud of having done. And it also opened these new horizons for me that eventually got me down the path that I follow. So be patient, keep all your options open, be curious, and explore maybe the passions that you have in yourself that you want to pursue for a lifetime.
I think that's such great advice. I you know, my experience is that with social media and with the way that everything is connected, there's a pretty strong gravitational pull that I feel, and I know a lot of people feel, to pursue defined paths or to pursue things as like, oh, this is a better path for everyone rather than this is uniquely suited for me. And then on top of that, there is, I often feel like a lack of patience, this desire. You see these perceived stories of overnight successes, and the expectation becomes like, wow, I should be able to make a decision, have certainty, and then it yields incredible results. And so what I appreciate about your advice there is both the introspective approach of knowing what was right for you, and then also the candor of the patience that required, that it wasn't decision success. There was some route finding, there was some having to kind of to find your way. And I think that's refreshing for me. I think it depressures when I hear that sort of advice.
No, that's absolutely correct. I would really underscore the importance of not comparing yourself to anyone else. The path you take is going to be yours, and you move forward at the pace that's right for you. Now, that's very hard for all of us. And I fell victim to that at various times in my career. Even after having joined the Foreign Service, I came in at a relatively late age into the Foreign Service. I was 35 years old. Most people are at least at the mid-career level at that point, or at least very often. And there were times when I would sort of glance to the left and the right and see, there were folks around the same age. They were already moving up the ladder, and here I was just on the first or second rung. After a while, though, you begin to realize, at least I did, that wasn't important. And of course, there were other factors that impinge on how one feels about the course he or she has chosen. Family is extremely important to all of us. How our partners are moving forward on the path they have chosen is extremely important. Raising our children, doing all those things that we all do. And so that's when you really want to sort of keep the blinders on and focus on what's important: yourself, certainly your spouse and your family. When you decide to launch, do it with vigor. Sooner or later, it'll all pay off. It certainly did for me. I was, in the end, extremely pleased with the way things turned out. Even my wife, who wondered whether I was really doing the right thing, in the end said that it was, in some respects, and I don't want to make it out like a fairy tale, because it wasn't. Foreign Service life is an extremely challenging life, in some respects, not unlike the military. But she said it was a wonderful lifestyle, and she doesn't regret it. But it did have some downsides too, and you just deal with those. But those are part of any path.
I appreciate that too. Not that the final success is necessary in these stories, but I appreciate that you started relatively late on a career path. And I can imagine for myself in a comparative setting, it would be extremely discouraging, but I love the thought of staying the course and doing work and trusting that that's the right path for you. And in your case, it did lead to really in your field, the epitome of success. That's the 4-star general is the rank that you achieved in this field. And I think it's refreshing to think that that came not from, you know, since age 5, I knew I wanted to do this. It's just, to me, I hope listeners hear that and they get a sense of relaxation of realizing they don't have to have everything figured out from the get-go.
No, in fact, you mentioned age 5. There were some of my colleagues who, from the time they became aware of what a diplomat was and what a diplomat did, wanted to be one. Mm-hmm. And here was, again, this interloper showing up. And I sort of happened on it over a course of 2 or 3 years just before I entered the Foreign Service. It didn't seem to have any impact on my career. I was very pleased with what I was able to achieve and the work that I did. It was extremely challenging and satisfying, and at the same time met some of the other so-called needs in terms of family and spouse and so forth.
Mm. And I want to get a little bit more into your time when you were deputy chief of mission and then when you were a U.S. ambassador. But first, could you maybe lay out for listeners the span of time from entering the Foreign Service to when you became deputy chief of mission and kind of just paint the picture of what life looked like during those years so they get a sense of what that initial career path looked like for you.
The rank structure of the Foreign Service is not unlike the officer ranks in the military. We're almost equivalent as you move up. You come in, I was fortunate because of my previous experience and graduate degree, I came in as a captain, but I still had to take the exam like everyone else. But some enter at the second lieutenant level. Mm. But the career path for most officers is pretty standard. The first assignment and often the second are done overseas, serving at our embassies in two different geographic regions. I started out in Latin America, as I said, in Nicaragua, and my second assignment was in Portugal. And then I came back to Washington, and I served for approximately 3 years, assignment in Washington, one of which was on what we call the seventh floor. It's where all the most senior officials of the State Department. I was on the staff of a couple of senior officials, including the secretary toward the end. And that's when I started out on my path. I'll also point out that at the time that I served there in Washington, I worked in what was then called the Office of Soviet Union Affairs during the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it was just an extraordinarily exciting, incredibly busy time to be doing diplomacy. I was traveling a lot to the Soviet Union, working with my colleagues in the embassy on various issues. But I then spent 2 years studying Arabic and was posted to Jordan, where I was economic counselor for 3 years. I served then in Oman as the deputy chief of mission, which is the number two to the ambassador. Went back to Washington again and served as a director of an office of about 30 folks, and then was tapped to go to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Initially, I went as a chargé d'affaires, who is the senior person in the embassy when there is no ambassador. I spent about 4 or 5 months in that position before becoming the deputy chief of mission in Saudi Arabia once the new ambassador arrived. And of course, it was after that, then I was named by president to be the U.S. ambassador in Oman. 3 years in that position. And then I was asked by the secretary to go to Iraq They needed some folks who had strong experience in the Middle East and Arabic language skills. And so I was the head of our political section, which was as big as many of our embassies are. Mm-hmm. It's an enormous section. And my final assignment in the State Department, I was seconded to the United Nations, and I worked out of Jerusalem in an organization called the Quartet, mm-hmm. working on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I had a pretty diverse career, although much of it obviously spent in the Middle East. I always felt that if you wanted to do that roll up your sleeve, hands-on work of diplomacy, there was no more challenging place in the world than the Middle East. And that certainly proved correct. it was indeed very, very challenging. So as I said, the ranks are very similar to the military, and it's usually between the 18 and 22 year point where you're considered for promotion into, you know, what we would call the flag ranks in the military. And we have a system, again, very similar to the military. It's up or out. If you don't make it into the senior ranks, then you have a limited time left, and then you retire from the Foreign Service. And I don't know what the stats are, but it's like a 20% or so make it into the senior ranks.
Mm. What is when you are ambassador, what does your day-to-day life look like? I imagine you going to a lot of social events. I imagine you doing a lot of research on the area, but could you paint the picture of what maybe a typical day looked like or a representative day might look like?
Well, first of all, you're managing a lot of people. Mm. And so there's the management of those people. You have a deputy, of course, and you have others in the embassy who have specific responsibilities. But at the end of the day, it's the ambassador who is the decision maker on many of the issues. And so there's that responsibility. You know, most people, when they think of diplomacy, and particularly an ambassador, they think about the social functions. And that's certainly an important component, that you represent the United States socially, not only to events where you're invited, but hosting events. And so my wife and I hosted many, many events mm-hmm. at our home, everything from small dinners with senior officials to very large gatherings to celebrate particular events, particularly our Independence Day, but other events as well. And also to ensure that all the various sectors of the society receive the attention of the United States through the U.S. ambassador. So I would try to cultivate relations with the business community, education community, women, students, even the religious community, which is very important in that part of the world. And I would also try to spend as much time as I could outside the embassy and even out of the capital city. I traveled to almost every significant town in Oman. I even embarked, it was probably about 7 or 8 months into my first year. I wanted to visit the sheikhs of the major tribes of the desert in the interior of Oman. And there were no roads out there, and there are no hotels, no restaurants. So we sort of had to stock up the way we used to do when I was leading a survey expeditions in some remote country, with supplies, camping gear, tents. People don't typically think of ambassadors as camping out to do their work. And I must have called on 20, 25 different sheikhs. I'd do 3 or 4 a day. By the way, they would host you at great feasts, and you'd have to talk to members of the tribe as well as the sheikh. I mean, it was actually great fun. And I took some of my staff members with me, who would often recall it as one of the most exciting mm-hmm. assignments they ever had. But again, it was the idea of getting a face of the United States out into the public so that they understood that we are a country that is genuinely interested in what people think and how they think, but also to convey the message of the United States to them about what our interests are, what we care about, and why their particular country is important to us, and the relationship is important. So your days are very busy. Typically, you know, you get in the office whenever you do, 8 or 9 o'clock, and there were times where, you know, I wouldn't get home until midnight. And very often my wife, I'll put it in quotes, was required. She doesn't like that term. She was really a great trooper and accompanied on all these events. And of course, she was a great host because I could not have pulled it out off without her help. But spouses are expected to be a part of the work that you do. Most spouses do it because they enjoy doing it. And of course, they want to support their own spouse. But then you have many who have their own careers and can't do it. But the days are long, they're challenging, lots of balls in the air. And of course, particularly in the Middle East, you're always facing the likelihood of dealing with a crisis later in the day or tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And we certainly had our share of those.
That's wonderful. I wanted to ask about the skills and characteristics that you learned in the military that helped you in that capacity, but maybe even more importantly, the ones that you had to fill in. And I just appreciate your story there because I'm hearing, you know, this sense of curiosity, and it seems like a tremendous amount of empathy to understand the lay of the land and where is needing your attention. But could you maybe highlight what benefited you from the military, but also what you had to fill in along the way?
Oh, there were many, many things that I felt gave me an advantage in my career, having served in the military. Take, for example, in the military, we become accustomed to working in teams. It's all about working together and achieving the mission. And so I felt very comfortable. And that's something that doesn't come normally to folks in the Foreign Service initially, because we do have more or less the same concept, but it has to be developed organically. But I sort of came into it already well accustomed to it and fit very comfortably into it, whether I was a team member or the team leader. And that was a tremendous advantage. Number two, I think in the military, we sort of take for granted that we're working in very diverse and a very diverse organization. You have Americans from all over the country, from all sorts of backgrounds, ethnic groups, religions, races, and so forth. And you learn to work together. And that was extremely helpful and valuable to me because the Foreign Service is very similar. Moreover, of course, when you're serving overseas, you're sort of forced into an environment that's not yours. It's a foreign country. They speak a different language. They have much different customs. They dress differently. They believe differently. And sometimes even their value systems are a bit different from ours. But probably one of the most important skills that I think I was able to bring from my military service into the Foreign Service was leadership. Many Foreign Service officers, when they enter the Foreign Service, have had no previous leadership experience. It's actually a rarity. Having served in the military, having gone to a service academy, I understood leadership. I mean, can't say completely understood it, but I was familiar with it. I knew what was necessary. I knew what to look for. I knew, particularly at the State Department, that I wanted to keep my eye on leaders there whom I admired and might want to emulate at some point in my career. And by the time I did reach a leadership position, I felt very comfortable. And I know a number of cases of my colleagues who failed the first couple of tries out of the chute as leaders because they didn't know how to function as leaders. But you get it in the military at all the ranks, both as an officer or as an enlisted person in our military. And again, it's one of the things you kind of take for granted, but in fact is extremely valuable. And I'll have to say, Justin, that it was also very valuable in that intervening time between business school and entering the Foreign Service when I was in the private sector. I was very accustomed, you know, if I had to take charge of something, I did. It was, you know, I wasn't afraid of it. I wasn't intimidated by it. So these are things I think that are useful to keep in mind to veterans and to those considering leaving the service, is that there are these intangibles that you pick up that are worth their weight in gold, if you could weigh them. They're just enormously valuable and will come into play very usefully later on, regardless of what you might do.
It's one of the things I appreciate about your story is you build up this career capital in the military, you build up this career capital in business school and finance, and then you take a wildly different turn. But in the end, I'm betting towards the end of your career in the Foreign Service, you're able to utilize so many of these skills from the military and from the business world that you were able to apply in that. And it's inspiring to see the amount of time you must have spent learning new skills along the way and being out of your comfort zone. And then at the end, being able to bring together all of these different tools. And that's one of the things I wanted to point out for listeners is to your point about patience, it really seems like when you look at this long view, you had decades to pull together different skills. And then at the capstone moment of that portion of your career, you're able to deploy all of these that you had built up over a lifetime. And so sometimes I feel in a rush. I know other people in their audience feel like in a rush to get to a destination, but I think your story illustrates the long view and how that patience plays a big role in this.
No, that's just, I mean, I think you explained it very, very clearly, Justin. It's a progression. You accumulate knowledge, experience, and at some point, you may not even be aware of it, wisdom that represents the accumulation of those experiences and all that you've learned in your life to a certain point. And I can't, you know, point to any single moment and say, aha, now it's all out there and I'm ready for the Super Bowl today. It all of a sudden, you know, you find yourself doing things, and it's a reflection of that experience, that knowledge, all the things that have come into play throughout your life that sometimes may have felt a bit frustrating in doing or acquiring, but sometimes there's a reason for it, and it's important to keep yourself conscious that as you go through a particular career, whatever it might be, that you want to you want to learn. And it's not just doing things, it's observing others, observing the people who are above you and how they lead, how they manage, how they behave, observing your colleagues, your peers, And if you're in the position, your subordinates, because all of them can teach you something. And I know, particularly in the Foreign Service, when you're immersed in these foreign cultures, then you're really in an almost alien environment. And it forces you to go into observation mode because the rules for behaving in that environment are so different. And that's a good thing. Don't act until you have some understanding of what the rules are, what the standards are, what's expected, and so forth. But more broadly speaking, that helps, I think, in your development as a human being, a person, but also as a professional, whatever the career field might be.
And from an outsider's perspective, it almost feels like you've had three or maybe even four careers, the military and then business and finance and then the Foreign Service. And now you're on to other things. And I'd love for you to share with listeners a little bit about the work that you do now.
Yes, now. So I'm on the faculty at the University of Denver. It's Corbell School for International Studies. And I teach Usually teach about two classes a year, so it's not a particularly heavy load, thankfully. But I also try to be available to students who have an interest in pursuing a career in foreign affairs. I do a lot of public speaking, and I also write a lot. One of the almost obligations that I feel that I have is to educate people about the events of the day and their meaning, particularly as it pertains to international affairs and U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, which I know best. And occasionally I'll talk about other issues as well and write about them. Just to take two examples, very, very recently in the last week, the rising tensions between the United States and Iran. And so we had a very large public event at the university. I had myself and a faculty colleague and talk about the implications of these rising tensions and so forth. And so it's extremely enjoyable. And I'm happy to share what I know with those in the audience. And then the recent passing of the Sultan of Oman, Sultan Qaboos, and I've done some media interviews and I've written some articles about my experiences serving there twice and what I knew about him, his leadership. Now I could have gone back into public, into the private sector when I left the State Department, but I really felt that I wanted to share the great opportunities and experiences that I had, and academia seemed to be the best place for that. And I'm enjoying it. I love interacting with students, talking to them, and getting challenged by them because they're curious and they want to know, ask lots of questions. Sometimes I don't have all the answers, but it's a learning process for me as well. And it's very satisfying.
That's wonderful. I love this consistent thread of service, and I love how it's taken different forms, military, foreign service, and now serving in a different way through your writing, through the work that you do with students and passing this knowledge along. I think that's great, and it's knowing that about you, and not that that's not a component of finance, but I could see how that typical career path might not fulfill that itch to serve, to give back, and it's makes me feel very excited that you followed that hunch and you stuck with that.
No, the service element was very important to me. I think I mentioned earlier in our discussion that I left the private sector because I missed public service. Mm-hmm. You know, I tried the military, and as challenging and helpful as it was to me, it just wasn't the place where I thought I could, you know, spend a career. But I missed public service, and the foreign service was the perfect answer for this yearning I almost had. It had some structure, but not quite as structured as military service, but it still had the very, very important component for me of serving the country.
That's great. I wanted to ask about resources. I always like to ask this for people who may be on a ship or deployed and have an interest of delving more into this career path, but can only access books or podcasts or movies or conferences, things like that. Is there anything that you would recommend to listeners that might inform them more about this sort of career path or maybe helped you in your own?
Well, there are certainly many, many more resources available today than there was when I was searching around. In my case, I would write letters or go to the library to research this sort of thing. But today, thankfully, there's so much available to folks online. I would say the first stop, particularly if you're interested in the Foreign Service. And by the way, there are many career paths in the Foreign Service. There's the diplomatic career path, but we have many, many other specialists that we use, whether it's in technology and communications, whether it's in finance and budgeting, personnel management, and so forth. And so I suppose the first thing that I would recommend if the State Department and Foreign Service is something that might interest them, go to the state.gov website, and there's a drop-down menu about career information and in all its various forms in the State Department. Not all employees of the State Department are in the Foreign Service. In fact, only a tiny minority are Foreign Service. We only have a service of about 12,000 people, as hard as that is to believe. Most of the people are civil service who follow the normal civil service track. While they can serve overseas, typically they don't. They serve in Washington or some of our other domestic offices. So take a look there, see what's available, what might interest them. And then there are lots of other materials that are available. There's a book out about life in an embassy. What's it like? Whether you're in your ambassador or a junior officer on the first tour. There's so many groups in social media now of actively serving Foreign Service folks, and you can tap into those, and then you can hear firsthand the experiences, including some of the more challenging ones, the family separations, which folks in the military, of course, know too, the challenge of spouses who also have professional interest, but they're hard to meet when the employed spouse is serving overseas, raising children in a foreign environment, so you can get firsthand information. And even the State Department itself puts out all sorts of information. There's an office called the Family Liaison Office. There's a Career Information Office. A lot of them that make information available. And then there are some public sources out there. Now you can download or buy a book if you want on what it takes to prepare for the Foreign Service exam. It's a fairly lengthy exam process. You can't study for it, but it's a different kind of exam than most people experience in their life, And so, it kind of helps you get into the groove of what it means to take that exam and what they're looking for when they test applicants. So there's a lot of information out there. And, I would also say keep up with, public events, international affairs, and you can read or hear about what American diplomats overseas are doing today, whether it's dealing with the trade issue in China or the tensions in the Middle East or civil wars in different countries and the day-to-day management of America's foreign relations.
That's wonderful. Well, I always like to leave the last question open-ended, and especially for this interview, I mean, we barely scratched the surface of a few of your positions, and there's so much that you've done in your career. We could spend an hour on each of them. I always like to make room to just allow you to share what do we not talk about that you want to make sure listeners know before we wrap up.
Well, the career path that I took in the Foreign Service was enormously satisfying in every respect. The work was challenging but gratifying. I learned so much. I was able to learn three languages as a Foreign Service officer. The colleagues with whom I worked were just exceptional people, very highly motivated as I was to serve their country and do the work that they were assigned to do as best they could. And then, you know, just the excitement of serving in a foreign country and exploring the country itself, its people, its culture, its history, its geography, everything. But I certainly wouldn't want to leave the impression that this is a road paved with golden bricks. It's anything but that. I served 3 years apart from my family, two when I was in Saudi Arabia, and then the year I served in Iraq. And it's difficult. It's difficult for me, but I'd probably say it was more difficult for my family. My wife then had to take up virtually all the chores of child rearing and all that comes with that, whether it's young children or older teenagers. Thankfully, with technology today, you can communicate much, much better than, say, my early days in the Foreign Service. And that's those assignments are not infrequent, just as in the military. And it's required in the Foreign Service that you serve what we call hardship tours, that you go to places where it's really difficult to live and maybe even dangerous, like Saudi Arabia was when I was there. We were living under the threat of an imminent terrorist attack, or in Riyadh, or in Baghdad, where the country was effectively going through civil war. And there are other countries, not necessarily at war, but they're very poor countries. So you live a pretty modest lifestyle, even though you're an American diplomat. You're not living high on the hog, so to speak. Modest home, so forth. But the work that they do is always important, regardless of the country. And I think all of us try to keep that in mind, that, yeah, you're in some pretty tough surroundings, doing a really difficult task, which makes it really challenging to do some of the basic things that you might be able to get done in a more developed country or country at peace. But it's all important to our country, most definitely, and it's certainly important to the countries where we worked. So I think it's very useful to keep a balanced image of what this type of career entails. It's mostly good, but not always and not all.
Well, Ambassador, thank you for the nuance that you brought to the discussion and the authenticity of the pros and cons throughout your journey. And I just really appreciate your sharing your story with the Beyond the Uniform audience.
Not at all, Justin. It was a pleasure, and I wish all your listeners the best of luck, and hope maybe I'll see some at the university or as our future diplomats.
Beyond the Uniform is written and produced by me, Justin Siri, with help from our Chief of Staff, Steve Bain, and our editor, Kathleen Dillon. We are an all-volunteer organization and would greatly appreciate your help in any of the following ways. First, spread the word. Beyond the Uniform has over 330 podcast episodes and 15 on-demand webinars, all offered for free. Help us spread the word on social media, at military bases, or whatever gets this resource in front of more men and women who need it. Positive reviews on iTunes go a long way towards this as well. Second, sponsorship. Beyond the Uniform relies on sponsorship to keep us going. There is so much more we'd like to do, but we don't have nearly the resources to do so. If you know of a company that would like to advertise in any way with Beyond the Uniform, please send them to beyondtheuniform.org. Third, donations. If you're in a financial position to donate, you can find more information on the support section of beyondtheuniform.org. At our website, beyondtheuniform.org, you'll also find 330-plus episodes categorized by industry, functional role, and more. You'll find a link for live events, typically 4 per month. You'll also find both free and for-purchase books that take a deeper dive on topics related to career growth. Thank you for your support as we aim to help members of the military and their families thrive in their post-military career and life.